Radio Vermont, WDEV, takes no responsibility for the opinions or statements made by the House Calls Vermont show host or their guests. The information provided during the House Calls Vermont show is offered only as a public service and should not be used as a substitute for obtaining any professional advice from a licensed professional.
Our house in the middle of our street. Our house in the middle of our...
WDEV presents House Calls Vermont. Hosts Jim Bradley and Chris West share their knowledge and expertise on topics specific to the opportunities and challenges of building and renovating in Vermont. Brought to you today by Haddon Home Center, Mason Drive, Waterbury. Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing, shamrockpaintingcompany.com. RK Miles, your neighborhood lumberyard with new locations in Barry, Montpelier, St. Johnsbury, and Waitsfield. Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. Curtis Lumber, there's a Curtis Lumber near you. Find where at curtislumber.com. Matt Clark's Northern Basement Solutions, for all things basement-y. NorthernNEFoundations.com. Vermont Home Builders and Remodelers Association, homebuildersvt.com. Poly Construction in South Burlington. One call does it all. Online at polyconstruction.com. Your participation is encouraged. Call the listener line with questions at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Now, House Calls Vermont with Jim and Chris.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Joel, for that introduction. I'm here with my good friend and colleague, Chris West.
How's it going, guys?
And my name is Jim Bradley once again, and we are here with House Calls Vermont. Should you have any questions regarding your home improvement projects, your new build, or just some other type of building science-related question, please feel free to give us a call today. We do love the interaction with our listening base. Would be 802-244-1777, and we'll be getting to those calls just a little bit later. This week, we wanted to address a few things right up front. First and foremost, we are so encouraged by the number of emails we've been getting from a lot of our listeners with great questions. I mean, all of them have just been some of the things we've been talking about that week or other projects, and it just is highlighting the fact that this is a really needed resource out there.
Yeah, so we're really excited about hearing from you guys and what your questions are. And forgive us if sometimes it takes us a little long to get back to you just because life is extremely hectic these days. I did want to say we are going to be starting our indoor air quality survey in this next week. So if you have sent in an email or called in and give us information, we'll be contacting you this week. Everybody will get an email about the beginning of the survey. And then we're going to be contacting individuals about setting up times to make sure you get the indoor air quality monitor and when we can pick it up and distribute it to the next people. So keep an eye out for that. But this week, we're talking...
There was one thing we wanted to get to first, because this was a very valid point.
Yeah.
We did get one of those emails from one of our listeners, and it was a gentleman who basically said, loves the show, but thought that some of the recommendations we were making would basically be out of the financial reach of most consumers.
Too expensive,
and yet, you know, still looking for advice on some of the assemblies. We get that, you know, because that's some of the items up front that we're considering, especially like we're doing a new build or a substantial renovation, or if you find horrific problems in the house, getting that corrected because someone didn't do it right in the first place, that can be really expensive to make this right. But then you got to look at the long-term payback. And, you know, I know a lot of these different manufacturers out there of certain products, especially roofing materials, things like that, they'll base their warranties on how long they think you're going to stay in the house. So they have a 10-year limited lifetime warranty, but yet that 10 years, we're betting you're out of the house within 10 years and it's non-transferable, so they're never going to have to, you know, perfect the warranty. They're never going to have to exercise that in the course of your ownership of the shingles. And so with that, we have to be really careful about what we're recommending, but at the same time, it's not that it's not worthy of the investment to make the structure in the house sound. And so sometimes there's more of an upfront cost, but what it yields you on the other side are savings from your utility bills, your durability issues in the house, and more importantly, your health and safety.
Health and safety.
Exactly. You know, if something doesn't work and you end up expiring in the house, what was that worth? You know, you could have avoided that. Or a health condition. Somebody has asthma, and you can correct that environment situation and then avoid a lot of these expensive medical bills. Sometimes that's hard to connect those dots, but when you do, you see that it's definitely a cost savings instead of a you know, more of an expense. And so today's episode, and Chris is going to get into this first, you know, really communicates right to that, because people will say, oh, it's too expensive to do it this way. But you look at the long-term benefits and the way that you can actually be cash flow positive from day one, it's worth the investment. So, Chris, go right ahead and kick us off here.
Okay, we've been talking about building science. That's our thing, right? And we're going to be getting deep into the building science today. You're going to say, oh, we haven't been in deep yet. No, actually.
We're jumping off of.
Right. What would happen if we took the available results of all of the data and information we have about building science and the experience we have in the world and applied them all in one house with the goal of making the house as energy efficient as possible within reasonable expectations of economic payment or what it costs? Well, in 1991, a German building scientist named Dr. Wolfgang Feist in Darmstadt, Germany, developed the Passive House Standard. A set of targets for energy use during the heating and cooling seasons. These targets were based on an American experiment done in the 1970s where scientists were busy trying to make houses use less energy because of the oil crisis in the 1970s. The American scientists called this the low-cal house or low-calorie house. So the whole idea of super-insulated houses, although it was finalized and spread by this scientist in Germany in the 1990s, it was actually started by American scientists at Champaign and Urbana in America in the 1970s. And I'll be putting a link to the original paper that was printed by that study. And it was a breakthrough in thinking about how houses work and how to use the more energy efficient without sacrificing the things we want from a house and the type of houses we live in now. So I'll give you a quick story about a passive house that was built here in Vermont.
Wait a second, Chris. I know what a passive house is. Isn't that a passive solar?
No. So first of all, we get that all the time. We always say we get things all the time, but that's a really standard one. In the 1970s, there was a system devised, you know, called passive solar houses. And what they did is they just made a really big south-facing wall and they filled it with windows with the idea that gaining and capturing those solar heat gains were going to be good for you and were going to reduce your heating loads. And not thinking about air tightness, not thinking about the walls or anything like that. Just lots and lots of glass. Well, that had a couple of really, really bad outcomes, and that the main one was that you were overheating in the winter because you had way too much sun coming in, and then you had to do something crazy with shades in the summer. So in order to understand, we're not talking about passive solar houses. Thank you, Jim, for pointing that out. We're talking about passive house. And the reason they call it a passive house is because the main strategies for heating and cooling are in things that don't use energy to work, right? A passive thing. You build a wall, that's just sitting there. That's not actively churning out anything like a heating system or a cooling system. Yeah, or a ventilation system.
But at the same time, as it sits there, it's still highly functional, right, if it's designed and built correctly.
Exactly. So the passive house, the bits of a passive house that make it a passive house are super insulated walls, they're super air tightness, they're those high quality windows, and all those things go together with a little bit of electrical instead of a mechanical. Instead of having a house that's pretty leaky, not very good walls, not very good windows, and in the end you have to throw a lot of energy at it through a boiler or an air conditioner in order to make it reasonable to live in it. The whole idea of the passive house is that we actually put our energy and money and experience into the assemblies, the walls, the roof, the floor, the windows, and those things reduce the load, the actual amount of energy that has to go into the house to make it comfortable. So we've had a lot of these built in Vermont. Vermont is actually one of the leading states in the nation per capita on the number of passive houses and other super insulated type houses that have been built. And there's a great story that I have. One of the things we like to do when we build these houses is we like to put monitors in them. And those monitors monitor temperature, relative humidity, and other types of information both inside and outside. And we have data from a lot of these houses. And one of them is from the stories that I love to tell is from a house that was built in Norwich, Vermont. And we have data from January of 2013. In 2013, it was minus 23 degrees in this house. Nobody was home, and the heating system was off. It was not yet morning, and the outside temperature, minus 23, the inside temperature without having any heating on at all, was 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
The important thing is, though, they had lost power in this area. There was a power outage.
Right. We had, so there was no mechanicals working in the house. It was the passive bits of the house that were causing it to be 50 degrees when it was minus 23 out. And when you look at the monitor information as you're watching the data, you can actually see the temperature rising from about 50 degrees up to about 60 degrees. And you're like, well, what's going on there? And then you look at the times and you realize that's when the sun rose.
Mm-hmm.
Because the solar gains were enough to raise the interior temperature by 10 degrees. So that's the type of thing we're talking about here. We're talking about investing a little bit more, somewhere around 10% more in the cost of the actual building itself, and then having about a 90% reduction in your fuel costs. We have data and information on houses, a 1,200 square foot house in Charlotte that was using an average of $20 a month for heating in the middle of the Vermont winter.
And let me take a step back and reemphasize what Chris just said, because you can go by it too quickly sometimes and miss the real golden opportunity there. Because some people say, building to this standard, gosh, you're just an energy geek. No, you don't have to be. That'll be just too darn expensive.
Yeah.
Well, not really, because it just depends on how the mortgage companies are looking at this. And, you know, that are when you go out and take a mortgage out, a lot of them just look at the cost of value of the house and how it appraise and everything else. The market is starting to catch up. You can actually start to do appraisals with energy efficiency in mind to add the value to the house. But when you look at this and you do the numbers and you compare a list of what is your monthly mortgage payment along with your current utilities expenses on a current code compliant or less house, you know, the existing housing stock and not even to current codes, and you compare that to a passive house, what Chris just said is you can use 10% less. You can choose 10% overall energy compared to what you would use on a code compliant or less house. And so if you take that and you reduce your utilities by 90% of that bill and apply it to a mortgage where you might have cost you about 10% more to 15% more maximum to build to the passive house standard, you come out cash flow positive.
From day one.
Exactly, from day one. And it's just getting the mortgage companies to really recognize that instead. So capture that. I mean, it's not that it's going to cost you more. And then the other savings you're going to get, we're going to dive into from just the durability, but the health and safety. There's so many more where it will be really financially a much better option. But right now, we do have a call on the line, and it's David from Lindenville. David, good morning, and go ahead with your question for us.
Yes, I just built a small 26 by 26 ranch style house with a full basement with a walkout. And my basement, I've been having on the parts of the walls that's concrete.
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, and where the walkout is, you know, the walkout ground level, but I have like a 4 foot drop on each side of the doorway with windows.
Okay.
Then there's about 6 feet that turns around a corner to the rest of the basement on that side, and on the other side is like a 2 foot turn go around the corner in the full wall.
Okay.
But there's like a 2 foot spot just below the top of the basement that gets frosty and all wet on that one on the left side of the basement, and on the right side of the basement on the same style, about the same place, it gets all wet and frosty. It was even like turning a little moldy, but we was running wood heat, but we stopped running wood heat. I got a boiler and now we're running, you know, regular oil heat there, but it still seems to do it when at a certain times, and I don't know what's really causing it.
Okay, so many questions come into play there, David. Is first and foremost, you say this is in the basement. Okay, so is it bare concrete walls,
yeah,
and are they insulated on the outside? I mean, could you explain the assembly a little bit to us?
Yeah, no, they're not. There's not no insulation. The guy was going to put styrofoam on it, and he didn't do it.
Yeah.
I think maybe we should have had it, but, you know, there's no the dirt
okay.
level is down lower on the front because, you know, it being open there.
Yep,
okay.
So I was wondering. And we haven't had much sunshine this year to warm it up.
Yep.
And that's the next question, too, I was going to ask, is where the solar gain is and, you know, the orientation of the home. First and foremost, when was this house built again?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. First and foremost, that's an Arby's violation. So that's a residential building energy standard violation if the basement walls were not insulated to at least an R15 standard.
And that's on the builder.
And that's on the builder, not you. They were supposed to. And you cannot sign your rights away. The builder is obligated that you contracted with to make sure that they meet those codes. So that's the first thing, and that's where some of your issues are coming in. Because keep in mind, when you have 8 inches of concrete, which is great structurally, that has the same insulation value or performance value of a single pane of glass or R1, which isn't much. And so then you're going to have that possibility of being a super cold assembly there, and any ambient moisture inside the room, inside the space, will hit that cold surface, and then the dew point will cause it to drop moisture on the wall, causing for that condensation buildup and that icing at the same time because it gets so cold, and then it can lead to mold. So first and foremost, I think you need to explore getting the right type of insulation on the inside of those walls, because that's going to be easier to do it there. Make sure it is either fire rated or it has some kind of thermal slash ignition barrier over the insulation, and that's going to solve that. The whole other question of the Arby's code and residential building energy standard,
and discussing whether or not your builder in some way moved the responsibility from him to you. We've seen that before, where you sign some kind of agreement where you're the GC and then they're no longer responsible. That's something we'd need to look at as well. But do us a favor. Get in touch with us through the email, housecallsvt@gmail.com. I want to follow up with you about this and talk to you about who the builder was. You don't have to mention it on the air, but we want to follow up and make sure that you're well taken care of. But it's what Jim is saying is absolutely right. It's all about the controlling of the dew points on that wall so that we don't have condensation, and that will be with interior insulation. We'll have other questions about the perimeter joist bays and other things, but that's what we're going to cover right now on the air with you. If you can just send us that email, or if you just wait until after the call, Joel will come on and we'll get your information, and we'll be able to get back in touch with you. Okay, David?
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome, David, and thank you for the call.
Right now we have Karen Bushy from Efficiency Vermont. Karen is a consultant, an energy consultant, probably a senior energy consultant at this point, right, Karen?
No, not quite yet.
Oh, when do you get your stripes? That's something we got to figure out. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Jim and Chris.
Yeah, same here. And of course, I know that for a fact that Karen is a certified passive house rater. So she actually gets to go in and say, is this something that's meeting the standards or is not?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, just to throw all of our bona fides out there, I'm a passive house consultant and passive house consultant trainer. Jim is a passive house certified builder, and Karen is a certified passive house consultant and a certified passive house rater. What does a rater do? What's the job of a rater in the whole passive house world?
Yeah, thanks for asking. That's a good question. So on top of being an energy consultant and a HERS rater for Efficiency Vermont, I'm also a FIAS Plus rater, as you mentioned. And FIAS is a term, I'm not sure if you mentioned that yet today, but Passive House Institute U.S. So you'll find me just abbreviating it as FIAS very frequently, so I don't have to spell that all out. But that type of rater is a resident certified and has been trained and certified by FIAS to rate and perform quality control and quality assurance for FIAS Plus standards, which you'll hear more about, I'm sure.
Yep.
And a rater's required for projects seeking certification for the Passive House Institute U.S.
Right.
It has been up until now. There are some changes afoot, which maybe Chris and Jim will be getting a little bit more into, but...
Exactly. So historically, a passive house, if you're going to build a passive house, whether it's a small house or a large building, multifamily or something, you have to have someone like me, a passive house certified consultant, help you to build an energy model and design it. And once it's being built, it's Karen's job, or someone like Karen, who is a rater, to make sure that the building is actually built the way the model is showing it was designed. It's kind of the, you know, quality assurance and quality control of the whole system.
Right. You got that right, Chris.
Right.
So a FIAS reader is kind of uniquely trained to understand passive house principles and challenges. So working with a reader, you know, similar to working with an energy consultant, all through the design and construction process can help a project stay on track to certify successfully at the completion.
Well,
and a rater can be involved in anything from you know, preliminary design through on-site verification, which is where our main role is. You know, we make a lot of trips out to the site during construction, and all through to verify things, anything from like sub-slab insulation to make sure that that's in place and not missed, which can easily happen or be changed and not realized until the end,
right.
To air sealing and then, you know, the final air sealing verification, which is pretty stringent.
Yeah, the air tightness requirements are very, very strict. And you're, and people who do your work are like the people who are making sure that although I put in the program when I'm doing the modeling, it's going to be this tight that it actually hits that in order to get this final certification.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the one thing I think is important here that we look at is in the state of Vermont is that there really isn't a great inspection mechanism in place. A lot of it's due to funding to actually go out there and check on homes, new construction, even just code compliant homes.
It is the Wild West.
It is the Wild West of New England. But to have this mechanism in place to where you actually have a plan that's developed early on in the build process, as they're saying, it's called part of the integrated project design, where you bring in architects, builders, some of these consultants for the Passive House organization, and you get everybody's input when you're designing the home. So a lot of brain power goes in at the forefront to make sure you can avoid excessive costs on the other side, figure these things out, and then along the way, you actually inspect what's being done. You don't expect, you inspect. You make sure that the plans are being carried out, not that you had a great design, but it actually gets implemented in place,
right.
And at the very end, you actually make sure it's been done appropriately, test the results, verify, and you're actually getting what you pay for and what your expectations were. And I think that's so vital in our state, but it, throughout all of the building industry, and thankful to have that here for sure.
In the history of Passive House, one of the criticisms of Passive House is that the certification process is laborious and costs a lot. And I remember a number of years ago, Efficiency Vermont, because the Passive House system until recently, and I'll get into that later, was saying, okay, you need to hire me as a consultant and Karen as a rater or someone like us, and we have to have all of these levels of modeling and back and forth. And Efficiency Vermont said, you know, you can get a really, really, really good house if you go the Passive House route. Well, what do we do if we just pull back a little of all of that modeling? And they came up with something called the High Performance Tier Building System, which is a program through Efficiency Vermont, which is prescriptive. Instead of needing a consultant like me to do all the modeling, you still have a consultant, and that consultant will guide you through what the minimum requirements are, air tightness, R values, but you can then build it without needing to incur the cost of someone like me. It's not quite as efficient as a Passive House in the end, but it is still a really, really good building system. Karen, can you tell us a little bit about the High Performance Tier program?
Sure, definitely. So, yeah, I'll be another one to admit that building a certified Passive House is not for everyone. There is an expense to it. So for people who want to get close to that but sort of avoid the hassle of the certification and, frankly, the expense of it as well, Efficiency Vermont offers two tiers of our programs. I'll talk about both of them. So we have the Efficiency Vermont Certified Base Tier and the High Performance Tier. And these are residential new construction, so completely new construction or complete gut rehab, which is going to have all of the characteristics. So they're prescriptive programs with kind of, you know, minimum R values for assemblies and efficiencies for equipment, maximum U value for windows. And they have incentives for each tier. Currently, those are at $2,500 for the base tier and $3,000 for the high performance tier. And there's actually an additional $1,000 bonus available for homes that go all electric, which meet certain criteria that we lay out. Those programs, you know, they're above and beyond what code requires. The base is, you know, kind of just one step above code, and then high performance, as Chris already mentioned, is sort of a step down from Passive House, but prescriptive program, so sort of easier to follow, just check the boxes, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, for example, a code wall might still allow, well, it does still allow R20, all cavity insulation, so fluffy insulation between the studs. Efficiency Vermont base level would require a minimum of R26 for that wall, exterior wall assembly, and the high performance would require R40 minimum,
right,
for exterior wall assembly. And both of those can, include some continuous insulation required.
So, Karen, a question that has come to me often, and I know that you've been involved in some of this as well, and I was wondering if you can comment on that. With respect to how do the buildings actually perform after the fact? I know Elm Street, the senior living place in Milton, there was an issue with some of the energy use, and then the checks and balances were put in place even after the construction to find out, hey, what's really going on here? We're seeing a little bit higher expected energy use than we thought, or, you know, we have some houses, I think there was three of them that were all built in the same time, and each of them had a different family unit there. And the one variable that changes is the occupants. And so what have you seen as a follow-up to some of these builds after you've been in there, and then time goes by and you come back and check on things later?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Jim. We don't know what's going on in all of these houses because we're not monitoring all of them. You know, that would be great to know exactly like what the energy use is and how people are using the home. The ones that we have looked at, we've seen that for the high performance homes, they really are for the most part performing very well. But there is that, that factor of the occupant and how they're using the home and how they're using the heating and cooling system. What else is going on in the home that can really change those final usage numbers pretty dramatically. For the Elm Place project, that is a pretty unique story. And we were able, because of the third-party verification that happened through Passive House certification, we knew exactly what was going on in those walls and the floor. We knew what the air leakage was.
Sure.
And so we were able to sort of dial the problems down to the mechanical system and realized that it was a fairly new type of multi-split heat pump that went into those apartments. And through that, through some additional monitoring that we did, we were able to figure out that there was some excess energy usage that was happening with those.
Right. It was the heat pumps were not acting the way that the manufacturer told us that they were going to be acting. And in the end, being able to monitor that and test that against the other information we had allowed us to go back to the manufacturer and say, you lied to us, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good one. That, of course, using the word lie may be a bit strong, but misrepresented, maybe not even on purpose, right?
Yeah.
Well, Karen, that has been very insightful. Thank you so much for joining us. I know this is short. We could always talk for hours about this stuff, but thank you for joining us. And
can I make one more plug for Path to Zero?
Absolutely.
Oh, certainly.
I know we're talking about new homes here, but it's always important to think about those homes, or those homeowners who are not thinking about building a new home and what can they do? You know, say you're listening to this program and you're really interested in these Passive House concepts, but you're not thinking about building a new home. What can you do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot you can do, and it's a really good idea to sort of have a general goal that you're headed towards. And then as you do work on your house or replace appliances or replace mechanical systems, you know, you're constantly working towards that end goal of net zero, ideally. And there's a lot of resources on our website that can help you on this journey. So a good place to start is efficiencyvermont.com and go to our blog page. There's a bunch of really good articles that spell out some concrete steps that you can take right away. Also call us at 888-921-5990, and we'd be happy to help you figure out where to start.
Excellent, Karen. Thank you once again for that. And we look forward to having you back for some other compelling reason in the future, for sure. It's been great having you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, have a good rest of your weekend.
And so with that, you know, Karen highlights a really important point is, you know, there is a destination. There is a destination to being net zero or having a really effective home that is net zero and that's going to be durable, possibly and hopefully to the Passive House standard, but you're in an existing home already. And Chris and I were talking about this. It's about having, yes, a destination, but there's a path along the way. And if you're doing renovation work and you can get down that path as far as possible and implement as many of these principles into your renovation or repairs or whatever, you're going to be that much further ahead. And so it doesn't mean it's either Passive House or nothing. It's basically what standards can I put into my existing home to get there towards that destination. But right now we do have a call from Forbes in East Corinth. Forbes, thank you for joining us. And please, how can we help you today?
Hi, I'm sorry I missed her. I have a question beyond hammers and nails, and that is landscaping or foliage for both windbreak and also shading.
Mm-hmm.
What's the location-wise, and what's the best for either of those two issues?
So those are very good questions. It's obviously outside of the actual house. So when we're looking at shading, and I've had this question asked a number of times when we're doing passive houses, because they'll have landscaping, and that landscaping will at some point may turn out to shade the windows. But when we're looking at shading windows, we can look at landscaping, but we have to also think about what's going to happen when somebody buys a when someone is going to sell a house, are they going to keep those trees? I mean, you can plant trees and say in 5 or 10 or 15 years those are going to shade the windows and reduce our heat gains and reduce overheating in the summer. If it's a deciduous tree, that tree will probably drop its leaves and give you the access to the sun that you're looking for in the winter for those solar gains. But if you get someone who, if you sell the house and that house then has an occupant that says, gee, those are some ugly trees, and they chop them down, then your strategies can all just be for naught in that moment. For windbreak, when we're building a house, when we're designing a house, we do look at the wind axis. There is a scale of 4 different choices you can make, well shaded, partially shaded, not shaded, completely exposed. And those things speak more to the infiltration possibilities on the house. So if you're building a house and that house is going to be kind of leaky, then those things have much more of an effect on the overall performance of the house. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the prevailing winds basically in Vermont are out of the northwest.
Yep.
The cold ones. If you used an evergreen, it would seem like that would be a good way of blocking some of the high-level winds, cold winds.
And here's another thing to consider too, Forbes, is, and everybody needs to know this, is the fact that when you're looking at homes when they're being built, part of the thing when we're doing some of these designs is we use a program called Woofy, and it looks at the life cycle of the home with the given climate and some of the other things that you may do to affect the house. And it takes in solar shading for part of that equation. Because let's say you build a house today and somebody went in there, did a suburb, they cleared the whole land, no more trees left, and then they build a home to a certain standard. Then all of a sudden, everyone plants trees, and you can tell the maturity of most of these neighborhoods by how tall the trees are. And then after 10, 20 years, 30 years, these trees are much more mature, robust, and then they'll block more of the solar light getting to the house, and thus it'll change the profile on how the drying happens on that wall assembly or roof assembly. And what didn't fail today when it was first built can fail in 10, 20, 30 years from now when that sun starts to be obscured more. And so these things really need to be taken into effect on how it's going to affect the long-term performance of the
house. So what we don't want to do when we're designing the houses is rely upon shading or trees or other obstructions that can be removed at some point for the longevity and durability of that assembly. We want to build them so that they're going to be durable whether or not they're getting solar drive from the sun, drying it out or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. It would, I guess, determine where, of course, we have a great selection of different dwarfing style trees, too.
That's true.
And shrubbery. But how far back away from the building? I was looking at just cold winds sweeping in, which would be an energy issue.
Yep. So what I would just interject there is I would prefer to design the house so that it was tight enough that those cold winds would have less an effect, and so the blocking of the trees would be a good thing overall, but it would not necessarily affect the overall performance of the building.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, great. Thank you. I think it's all an important part of, building a building and not creating a desert of Vermont.
Absolutely.
Where winds can just sweep across a lot and cause a lot of thermal loss.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for calling in, Forbes.
Bye now.
Yeah. So I just wanted to jump back into the passive house thing. So when we're looking at a pass fail, so what are the strategies? First of all, we said we're using building science. And yes, if you're going to, if you really want to know more than you'd ever need to know about building science, taking a pass fail course is going to rattle your brain. I remember when Jim
It's all Chris's fault.
Jim was taking the Passive House Certified Builder course, and he called me from yesterday where he was taking the course, and he says, "You have ruined me," because he felt like he'd have to go back to all of these jobs he'd already done and fix them and make them better. And the answer is no. We accept what we didn't know in the past, and we move forward from this point. It's all good. So what are the strategies that we'd be talking about? Well, obviously we're talking about super insulation, and Karen pointed that out. A code wall right now is somewhere between an R20 and R25, depending on which package you're choosing, right? What are you going to have a 2x4 wall with 3 inches of insulation outside, whatever. When you start getting to the high performance and passive house numbers, those numbers get really significant. We're talking about almost a doubling of the R value of a wall. We're going from an R20 or 25 to an R40, right? We're talking about roofs that are, our minimum code is R49. We're talking about R60, R100. And on the slab and slab edges, we're talking about R20 and R30, when the code requires an R15. Yep. So, that's the insulation side, and that's where part of the cost comes from, and we also have to be very careful about making sure they're vapor open and that they're going to be durable well into the future.
And there's also the consideration on the structural component, because you can't just stuff more insulation into the same cavity and expect you're going to get hit those values. So you have to start doing a combination of what's on the outside of the wall and the inside of the wall, continuous insulation versus cavity insulation.
Double stud walls.
So there's a lot of different things that come in consideration. And when I took the passive house training that Chris mentioned, a lot of the builders at that point in time were saying their first two houses, they'll say, why the heck am I even going down this path? That makes no sense. Then after those first two, they say, why haven't we been doing this all along? Exactly. So it does end up making more sense once you get the processes and procedures down. So what may sound complicated now is readily achievable to get these performance.
And most of the building systems that we're talking, most of the assemblies, they're not foreign to a regular builder. They
exactly.
are different. They are new, but it's not like saying, oh, I've been using a diesel engine my whole life, and now I need to use a nuclear-powered something. No, it's really just a different way of building an assembly and keeping in mind certain important concepts. So that's the insulation. We're gonna wrap this baby in a blanket, and in that, we don't want thermal bridging, so we don't want, you know, high conductive materials going all the way through the assembly. We want to make sure that we're dealing with that first condensing layer to make sure that we're not going to have moisture in the wall.
Real quick on that thermal bridging that Chris mentioned is the fact that think of your wall cavity, which is traditional insulation stuffed in between the studs. Regular stud walls, because wood is only R1 per inch compared to insulation, it could be 3.5 to 7, whatever. It conducts cold into that cavity through the studs and chills down or modifies that temperature on standard wood construction by up to one third of its value. So it may be rated at an R19, R25, take a third off of that, and that's what you're going to end up getting.
If you think that when you're building a wall, just think about what percentage of that wall is wood. And what percentage of that wall is bay? And if we're talking about 24 on center, about 8% of that wall is going to be wood. And if we're talking about a 16 on center, up to 15% of that wall can be wood. So that changes the entire R value of the whole assembly. So that's insulation and thermal bridging.
Yep.
Air tightness. We've been talking about this forever.
Oh,
air
yeah.
tightness is the number one way to reduce the energy efficiency or increase the energy efficiency, reduce the losses of a house. So we're talking about a metric. It's about 0.6 air changes per hour at 50 pascals. The actual metric is 0.06 CFM50 per square foot of exterior envelope. And that's a big thing to wrap your head around. When we get to the video, I'll put a graphic up to explain that. But basically, we're saying if you took a square foot of wall, how much air moves through that wall? Right now, a commercial building or a standard building is 0.3 air CFM50 of the exterior envelope at 50 pascals. And the passive house is 0.06. You can see that we're talking about a fifth of the air leakage for a passive house.
And to put that into perspective, as we talked about before, we've seen houses not at 0.6 or less. We've seen houses that are 40 air changes, 40 air changes per hour,
yep.
and it's really leaky. And to put it in perspective, that's maybe easier to understand. We're talking about air exiting and air entering the building, which we call exfiltration and infiltration. So you want to stop that from happening. Unless you choose to open a door or a window, you don't want to have that wall assembly, roof assembly, floor assembly, allowing for that exchange of the air, because it's carrying with it some type of modified air that has temperature differentials in it that you're trying to keep at a certain temperature, and you don't want that getting out of the building.
Yep. When we're speaking of infiltration, we describe that as undesired or uncontrolled movement of air into the house. So if we're going to look at walls, assemblies, getting those walls really, really good, we know, and we've discussed this on two episodes of Windows, that windows are the weak spot in any building. When you have a wall that's an R40 wall and you put a standard window in there, that window could be an R3 window. That's a huge difference. And the inside temperature of those windows is always going to be a problem. That's why we put radiators under our windows.
Yeah.
Well, Passive House in Germany in the 1970s and started a huge revolution in windows. They now have over 50 manufacturers of windows in Germany, and they have really upped the game on the R value of a window. We now have thermally broken frames. We have triple glazed windows, and those windows are sitting there around an R6. The inside surface temperature of that window can be as little as 3 degrees different from your inside set point, which means that without heating the window with a radiator under it, if you are inside your house and walked from the inside where it's nice and warm towards the outside on a cold day, you would not be feeling the cold from that window because the inside surface of that window is so close to the inside set point.
And one of the problems that had been to find the right windows and to source those, usually they were European, once again, and you had to go to Europe to find those, whether it be Entis windows, Yarrow windows, Clearwall, and then the shipping costs came into play, where you could spend a $4,000 premium just on the shipping costs added to your whole house window package. And so from a renovation standpoint, it didn't make a lot of sense. But thankfully, there are more of the domestic providers for these windows that are coming to the market now. And there's one that we're using currently, Wife Windows out of New Jersey. And we just recently got a set of their windows for a new house build and been really impressed with the durability, the robustness of it, and the fact that the customer's been very happy. The installation has gone very smoothly, and every window has fit every opening. So that's been a really good thing, too. So
you brought up during the window episode that a company like Wife Windows in New Jersey, every window is a custom window. So you don't have a upcharge for doing a custom size like you would with a Pella or an Anderson.
Yep. And not to down those other domestic ones, but usually if you have an opening that's pre-existing, you've got to fit it. So if you don't want to have to modify it and go through that expense or pay that custom window premium, you can just tell them what rough opening you have. They'll provide you with the window that fits that opening at no additional cost. And that's a really good thing, too.
And their standard window is windows are discussed in U values, which is 1 divided by the R value. So if you want to know what an R value is for a U, you just take 1 and divide it by. It's a 0.17 window.
Yeah.
That's a really good window. That's an R6 window right there. And there are some options to get that number down a little if you want to spend some more money. So we are huge fans of Wife Windows. We're constantly telling our builder friends about them, and we're throwing a hello out to Darren Macri, who's listening right now. He just texted me from Wife Windows. How's it going there in New Jersey, Darren? We are going to be going right now, actually, to a caller calling in. Brenda from Huntington, how can we help you today?
Hi. Well, I this is the first time I've listened to your show, so I'm kind of totally out in the blue, and this might be an off-the-wall question, and it's really not about windows, but it's about, you know how we're all to tighten our houses to not let the heat come out and, you know, get everything tight, tight, tight? What about all the circulation in the house, and what about, you know, all the outgassing of all the, you know, the walls and the floors and the furniture and everything?
Nah. I mean, great questions.
Yeah.
Great questions. And thank you, first of all, for listening. We're glad that you're a new listener. And we'll just throw it in. We talk about this all the time. So when we make a house tighter, and then what we're doing is reducing the infiltration, right? That uncontrolled in and out of air. What we have to do is we have to add lungs to the system. So we add something called balance ventilation. And there are a number of different companies that make balance ventilation systems.
So can I ask? Pose the question a different way?
Sure.
Those of us who have, you know, leakier houses than houses that have all the things that the fittings that you're describing, it seems like they've got their own sort of natural ventilation.
Yes.
But not in a great way. See, here's the thing. We're talking about, interestingly enough, passive house. And passive house basically is we're trying to make it as efficient as possible, use less resources, and the assemblies themselves, once they're in place, they perform really, really well and they're highly functional, but you don't have to put more energy into them to make them work. In your situation, you've got a passively lazy, dysfunctional house when you have most non-code compliant homes. And so the walls are there, but they're not performing. So yes, it's leaky, and you may be leaking a lot of air, but when it gets out of the attic or the other spaces, it reinfiltrates because simple physics says what goes out must come back in to balance. And when it comes back in from unknown sources, when it comes back in from a leaky basement that's going through rodent droppings or going through mold
down to our basement all the time. I know exactly what's down in the basement. But you're right. I mean, maybe those things are causing the people living inside to be dysfunctional too.
We're not counselors. However, we can help you with this. And I say the first step you should take, because every house, no matter how new or how old, needs to have some type of a home performance assessment. And I know Efficiency Vermont has their EEN network of contractors. They can come out and take a look and just tell you, really, as a house is a system, because you don't want to just say, oh, gosh, I think I need more insulation. Let me just throw it in this space. That's not a good way to approach it. You want to approach the house first and foremost from the health and safety standpoint, then the structural durability standpoint, and then by default, you're going to be getting energy efficiency along for the ride. So address it that way. Look at the house as a system. Look at the ventilation, because, yes, you want to make the house tight, but you want to ventilate it right, because you do not want to close in, you know, stale air, more VOCs, like you mentioned, everything else. Yep. You want to deal with that, but you don't want to be introducing more because you have a leaky house and things are coming back in through spaces you don't want to be breathing the air from.
Okay. You're very good. And I'm going to go now.
Okay. Thank you so much, Brenda.
Answering my question.
You're very welcome. Have a good rest of your day. So here we are. I just wanted to point out, first of all, thank you, Brenda, for your listening and for your question. If you have a house and the house is checked and the air leakage is above 3 air changes per hour or 2 air changes per hour, it's not necessary for you to have a balanced ventilation system, right? Because your house is leaky enough that the wind is blowing, air out and air in as far as getting hygienic air in the house. Now, that's part of why we're having this indoor air quality analysis, the survey we're doing, so that we can see what's going on inside of your house. If you were, Brenda, to get an assessment and the assessment was, let's make your house tighter, and they made the house tighter to the point where it was necessary to install ventilation, balanced ventilation to make the indoor air quality good, then that means that your energy bills will also be going down because you won't be dealing with all of this infiltration, this uncontrolled outside air coming into your house that then has to be heated by your heating system. We'd be reducing that type of loss, and we'd be able to heat a smaller amount of air that would then also be healthier because we'd be bringing it in through a heat exchanger and through filters.
Yep.
Is it expensive? Absolutely. Doing that type of retrofit can be expensive, but it depends on where you're at in the ownership of the house and what you're planning on doing with the house in the future. In the end, we have 99% of our houses are old housing stock, and one of the biggest problems in the state is trying to come up with a system where people can invest in their houses and upgrade the health and safety, the durability, and the energy efficiency of their houses in a way that is good for everybody. That's what we're looking for. So we have Anne in Brookfield calling. Anne, how can we help you?
I'll tell you. It is not exactly what you've been talking about, but I've been trying to work on this for over a week. A lot of people in Orange County lost their electricity, okay? And if they don't have a backup, a generator, they do not have electricity to keep warm. They can't cook. They cannot get water. And we rent a house that's just what happened this last week.
Yep.
And it's just horrible. I mean, we know 3 years ago what it was like, and that's when we got a generator, but it's very expensive to buy a generator for a house you rent. So what would you do? I've called different people, and they say, oh, get a kerosene heater. But isn't that pretty dangerous? And also it'd be smelly.
Yeah, you've got to look at that. I mean, I remember back when we had the 1998 ice storm, and you know, there were people that were dying, people that should know better. Even they were running their generators at, you know, with their garage door open, and it ended up their family didn't wake up. That was one over near me and near Cambridge that happened. And so you want to be very careful of how you're going to be heating there. I've heard people trying to bring their barbecues in and actually heat the home that way, and it's just not a good methodology. No. And so with that, as far as what can you do now, presently, that's a tough one because there's not a necessarily immediate safe solution. One thing that Chris has been talking about, and he mentioned about the one home where they did do this in Norwich, where they did lose power for several days in a row just because of the normal heating and cooling cycle of the sun coming up and radiating and then warming up the house, they would have enough of a gain to where it would get near 60 degrees inside the house during the day, and at night it would never drop below 50. That's without building occupants. Then when you add a building occupant like yourself, you become a 100-watt heater all the time that is added to the actual heating component.
Every person
space. Exactly.
In rest gives off 100 watts of heat.
And so when you build this brand-new passive house, you can actually have a housewarming. And when you have your friends over, you're literally having a housewarming because they are adding to that. And so that's one method.
That certainly doesn't help your immediate question, though. I mean, a new solar. House. Yes.
Solar.
I don't think someone should.
It's an older house, but we did do a lot of things that I know Vermont, you know, wanted to have done.
Okay.
You know, to them, yeah.
Well, so I have a house that is super insulated, but before it was super insulated, we also had a wood stove in that house. That's very common in Vermont.
Yeah, and you can though when you rent.
Oh, that's is right. Interesting. Yeah. As I'm misunderstanding. So you own a rental unit.
Correct. It was my great grandfather's. Yeah.
I get it. Yeah,
and
there are restrictions.
I had to take the stove out, and that man was very upset with me. This is like three different renters.
Even a pellet.
And and they were very upset. But your insurance company will, and I understand because people don't know how to run wood stoves.
Yep.
But what about a pellet? Has there been any restrictions that you've seen on that? Because that could be another valuable option.
Don't know.
Okay, because not all pellets need electricity to have them operate effectively. So I would give some thought to that because that's a great, you know, fuel source at the same time, and it can work at all times, you know, whether you have power or not. I would check into that one. That would be my next recommendation for sure.
But they probably still couldn't get water. And
oh, true.
No, that's true. That's true. Yes, as soon as our power goes out on Hanley Lane, I fill the tub up.
There is what's called the Tesla wall. And Tesla wall is a battery storage type of device. GMP is offering these, and they're doing a lot of testing right now. That's something you could check into because basically on off-peak times, it recharges it, and then on-peak, you can actually draw from that. But they are purporting that this can allow a house to operate effectively for several days, even after a power loss. And the more that you conserve, of course, once you lose power, it'll last longer. But I would give GMP a call, see what that current program is, and see if that Tesla wall might be available in your area.
Okay. Well, thank you. But it just, I have talked to so many people, and there's no one that can figure it out because you can't have a wood stove.
Yeah.
And I know of people who've lost their homes with what you're talking about, too.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, that's very, very sad. We try to avoid that. So you're very right. And do not bring a non-vented propane heater into your house.
Oh, no.
That is just a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the kerosene, I think, is also.
Yes,
yeah,
similarly.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but we thank you for calling in, and I hope things work out soon.
Thank you.
You're
maybe
very welcome.
Someone will come through with something they can think of.
Well, do me a favor. Send us an email because I'm not certain that we're done thinking about this. Send us an email to housecallsvt@gmail.com.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
You're very
have
welcome.
A good day.
Okay. Chris, it looks like we have another call, and it's Bobby and Randolph. Bobby, go ahead with your question.
Okay. I really don't have a question. One of the things that we did was I kept half-gallon milk jugs, just fill them full of water. I know it's not for bathing, but you can at least have something to drink.
Yeah.
And when we had our system set up for electricity, we had a backup generator put in, and it didn't cost us a whole lot more because we already had the generator.
Sure.
Yeah, that storm-proofing your house, that's a very good suggestion. I like that.
Yeah, I know some people, when they know the storm is coming, they'll fill up their bathtub with water so they can have some type of flushing type of capability inside their house. So there are some of those stopgap measures, but sometimes you when you lose it, it happens instantaneously and you're not prepared. So definitely keeping something in standby with those gallon jugs of water would be a good recommendation for sure. So.
Yep. Thank you so much. Was there something else?
Welcome.
Nope. Okay. Well, thank you, Bobby, for calling
in.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Hey, Chris, you know what happened again?
We lost an hour. And
well,
it's
lose it. We invested an hour, but we have these topics that we come up with that we have this some kind of belief that will get done in the course of an hour.
Yeah, we're overachievers, and we're trying to get too much in an hour. So it looks like we're passing Passive House through to next week. We'll have a Passive House 2 next week. And until then, just remember, if you have signed up for the Indoor Air Quality Survey, you'll be getting an email from us this week about when you should be expecting to hear from us about getting that Indoor Air Quality Monitor, and then we'll collate all that information after we get it, and we'll share that with you on the air. It is 1:30, and this is Chris West for House Calls Vermont. Until next week.
And Jim Bradley as well. We'll join you then, and have a great week, everybody.
House Calls Vermont, brought to you by Hannon Home Center, Mason Drive, Waterbury. Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing. ShamrockPaintingCompany.com. RK Miles, your neighborhood lumberyard with new locations in Barrie, Montpelier, St. Johnsbury, and Waitsfield. Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. Curtis Lumber. There's a Curtis Lumber near you. Find where at CurtisLumber.com. By Matt Clark's Northern Basement Solutions for all things basementy. NorthernNEFoundations.com. Vermont Home Builders and Remodelers Association. HomeBuildersVT.com. Poly Construction in South Burlington. One call does it all. Online at PolyConstruction.com. Do join us next Saturday at 12:30 during the noon hour for House Calls Vermont.